Okay, very good. So today, hopefully, you've got your sheets of paper there. We're going to look through the Pasadaka Sutta. Because it's a long sutta, I can't have too many questions today. So we're just going to, I'll read a bit, and then we can ask for a question. But there's a lot to get through. So here we go, let's start. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This is one of my favorite suttas. It's got some quotes which I often read out during retreats. It is a talk by the Buddha mentioning after the then leader of the Jains passed away and why there was lots of arguments after he passed away. It does remind me of when Ajahn Chah passed away, and after at his funeral people were arguing about what did Ajahn Chah teach. And everybody had a different idea of what Ajahn Chah taught. And I must praise my predecessor Ajahn Jacaro, who stopped all the arguments by pointing out that we, in a teacher, we always perceive just our own spin of what Ajahn Chah was. And even with the Buddha, you know, what Ajahn Chah taught, what the Buddha taught, people will remember what was important to them. And what wasn't important, they will not remember. And so this is interesting that whenever there's any teacher passes away, there'll always be some discussion afterwards. What did he really teach? So anyway, this is what happened in the time of the Buddha. So this is Pasadaka Sutta, delightful discourse. Thus have I heard, once the Lord was staying among the Sakyans at the school building. Interesting having schools. In a mango grove belonging to the Vedanya family. At that time, Nigantha Nataputta, otherwise known as Mahavira, who was the leader of the Jains, which was far more popular, it seems, by most scholars' opinion, far more popular in the Buddhist tradition. So it wasn't so much this was the, not just a contemporary, but it was also competing in one sense with Nigantha Nataputta, but Nigantha Nataputta, the leader of the Jains, seemed to have more fame and more people following him. And he had just died at Pawa. And at his death, the Nigantas, the Jains, were split into two parties, quarreling and disputing, fighting and attacking each other with worldly warfare. You now don't understand this doctrine of discipline. I do. How could you understand this doctrine of discipline? Your way is all wrong. Mine is right. I am consistent. You aren't. You said last what you should have said first. And you said first what you should have said last. What you took so long to think up has been refuted. Your argument has been overthrown. You're defeated. Go on, save your doctrine. Get out of that if you can. So that's just a standard for arguments. You would have thought Nigantas, Nataputta's disciples, were bent on killing each other. Even the white-robed lay followers were disgusted, displeased and repelled when they saw that their doctrine and discipline was so ill-proclaimed, so unedifyingly displayed, and so ineffectual in calming the passions. It's an interesting statement there. You know, if it is properly proclaimed, if it calms the passions, and it stops disputes rather than creating disputes. Having been proclaimed by one not fully enlightened, and now with the support gone without an arbiter, a leader, to say what's right and what's wrong. Now the novice Chunda, who had spent the rains at Pawa, came to Samagama to see the Venerable Ananda. Saluting him, he sat down at one side and said, "Sir, the Nigantha Nataputta has just died at Pawa." And he related what had happened. The Venerable Ananda said, "Chunda, this is something that ought to be reported to the Blessed One, the Buddha. Let us go and tell him." "Very good, sir," said Chunda. So they went to the Buddha and told him. He said, "Chunda, here is a doctrine and discipline that is ill-proclaimed, unedifying, displayed, and ineffectual in calming the passions, because the proclaimer was not fully enlightened. Such being the case, Chunda, a disciple cannot live according to that doctrine and maintain proper conduct, nor live by it, but deviates from it. Now, because it's not something which calms the passions, in the end it doesn't create proper conduct. So here one might say, 'Friend, this is what you have received, and you have opportunity. Your teacher was not fully enlightened. You cannot live according to that doctrine, but deviate from it. In this case, Chunda, the teacher is to blame. The doctrine is to blame, but the pupil is praiseworthy. And if anyone were to say to that pupil, come now, Reverend Sir, and practice according to the doctrine proclaimed and given out by art by your teacher, then the one who urged this, the thing urged, and the one who so practiced it would all gain much demerit. Why? Because the doctrine is ill proclaimed. So they're saying here that, you know, if there's a badly proclaimed teaching and you encourage others to follow it, then that's bad karma for you. But here Chunda is a teacher who is not fully enlightened, and a disciple lives according to that doctrine and conforms to it. One might say to him, friend, what you have received is no good. Your opportunity is a poor one. Your teacher is not fully enlightened. His teaching is ill proclaimed, but yet you continue to live according to it. In this case, the teacher, the doctrine, and the discipline are all to blame. And if anyone were to say, well, Reverend Sir, by following that system you will be successful, the one who so recommended it, that which was recommended, the one who on hearing the recommendation should make still greater efforts, they would all gain much demerit. Why? Because the doctrine is ill proclaimed. You're still encouraging people to follow a path which doesn't lead anywhere. But here now is a teacher who is fully enlightened. Their doctrine is well proclaimed, edifyingly displayed, effectual in calming the passions. I always pause on that one. You can tell if something is properly proclaimed by its results. If it calms the passions, make people cooler, harmonious, more at peace, then it's a good teaching. And it's usually because of that enlightened teacher. But the disciple does not live up to that doctrine, but deviates from that good doctrine. In that case, one might say to him, friend, you have failed, you have missed your opportunity. Your teacher is fully enlightened, his doctrine is well proclaimed, but you don't follow it, you deviate from it. In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, but the pupil is to blame. And if anyone were to say, well, Reverend Sir, you should follow the teaching proclaimed by your teacher, then the one who urged that which was urged, and the one who so practiced, would all gain much merit. Why? Because the doctrine is well proclaimed. Urging a person to follow the good teachings is good karma. But now, Chunda, they always go through all of the possible combinations. But now, Chunda, here is a teacher who is fully enlightened, his doctrine is well proclaimed, and the disciple, having taken up, follows it, practices it properly, and keeps to it. Someone might say to him, friend, what you have received is good, you have a great opportunity, and you are following the doctrine of your teacher. In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, and the pupil is also praiseworthy, and if anyone were to say to such a disciple, well, Reverend Sir, by following that system you will be successful, then the one who thus commended it, and that which was commended, and the one who on hearing such commendation should make still greater efforts, all would gain much merit. Why? Because that is so when the doctrine and discipline are well proclaimed, edifying and displayed, and effectual in calming the passions. Because of the fully enlightened teacher and supreme Buddha. So in other words, if there's a bad teaching and you encourage people to follow it, then it's bad karma for you. And how is it a bad teaching? Because it makes people more argumentative, less calm, more angry, less harmonious. You can tell whether the person's becoming peaceful and calming the passions or not. And if you see a good teaching and it is calming the passions, you encourage someone to do that, that is good karma for you. It's also, I mentioned this as a byproduct, if any of you parents have got a child who wants to become a monk or a nun, and you say, no, don't do that, I will kill myself if you become a monk, daughter. They do that, you know, they say that, some of these mothers. That's bad karma. You're encouraging, discouraging a person from following a good path. So don't do that, mothers and fathers. But no, if, you know, your daughter said, I'm going to become a pole dancer, and you encourage that, that's bad karma. You say, no, don't do that, that's a bad profession. Then fair enough, you're making good karma. Okay. So pole dancer's okay, but don't become a nun. But now, Chunda, suppose a teacher has arisen in the world, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, and the doctrine is well proclaimed, effectual in calming the passions because of that teacher. But their disciples have not fully mastered that true Dhamma. The full purity of the holy life has not become clear and evident to them in the logic of its unfolding, and not been sufficiently grounded in them. being still in the course of being well proclaimed amongst humans at the time of the teachings passing away from them. That way, Chunda, the teacher's death would be a sad thing for their disciples. They haven't fully finished the path yet. Why? They would think, oh, our teacher arose in the world for us, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, whose doctrine was well proclaimed, but we did not fully master that true Dhamma as long as it was well proclaimed amongst us. And now our teacher has passed away from among us. That way the teacher's death would be a sad thing for their disciples. But suppose the teacher has arisen in the world and their disciples have fully mastered the true Dhamma. The full purity of the holy life has become clear and evident to them in the logic of its unfolding. And they have been sufficiently grounded among them while being thus well proclaimed amongst them by the time of the teacher's passing from them. That way the teacher's death would not be a sad thing for their disciples. Why? They would think, our teacher arose in the world for us and we have fully mastered the true Dhamma while it was thus proclaimed amongst us. And now our teacher has passed away from among us. That way the teacher's death would not be a sad thing for the disciples. So as long as the teacher has done their job, they've taught, established the Dhamma, enough people have understood it to keep on going, then it's not a sad thing when a good monk or good nun dies. So when I die, will you be sad? I'll wait and see. No, I won't be there then, would I? Anyway. So what about when your parents die? You can use the same thing here. You know, as long as they've done their job and you've learned what they've needed to teach you, that they have nurtured you to a state of independence, you have a livelihood, you have your health, you have your maturity, then as long as your parents have done their job, there should not be sadness when they passed away. Okay. So, paragraph 10. But Chunda, if the holy life is so circumstanced and there's no teacher who is senior of long standing, long ordained, mature and advanced in seniority, then in such a case the holy life will be imperfect. If such a teacher exists, then the holy life can be perfected in such a case. So even if a Buddha dies, as long as there's some senior teachers to carry it on, then it will be fine. If in such a case there is such a senior teacher, but if there are no senior disciples amongst the monks who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have attained peace from bondage, who are able to proclaim the true Dhamma, able to refute any opposing doctrines that may arise by means of the true Dhamma, and having done so give a grounded exposition of Dhamma, then the holy life is not perfected. In other words, you don't need just a senior teacher, you also need senior teachers. You know, amongst those senior teachers, people have actually penetrated the Dhamma, know what they're talking about. It's not just the case you've been many years in the robes. It's also those years in the robes have been well used, so you understand what the Buddha was talking. It's not just you understand what the Buddha said, but you are able to proclaim the Dhamma and able to refute any opposing doctrines. And so you may be able to give the grounded exposition of Dhamma, so you know you're able to carry on the teachings. In such a case, if there are such senior teachers and such senior disciples, but there are no monks of middle standing with these qualities, no junior monks with these qualities, no senior disciples amongst the nuns, no middle ranking or junior nuns, no white-robed lay followers, male or female, celibate otherwise, or if the teaching does not prosper and flourish, is not widespread, widely known, proclaimed far and wide, or even these conditions are fulfilled, has not gained them the first place in support, then the holy life is not perfected. So for any of you who still doubt the importance of the bhikkhunis, it says here, black and white from the Buddha, it is not nuns. No senior disciple amongst the nuns, middle ranking or junior nuns, then the holy life is not perfected. Okay, remember in Sri Lanka, still the bhikkhunis aren't respected. In Thailand, still not accepted. So we're perfecting the holy life here in Perth, way before Sri Lanka and Thailand. Woohoo! So read this. That's why I like reading this out, because it's black and white from the word of the Buddha. It's powerful stuff. If, however, all these conditions are fulfilled, then the holy life is perfected. So But that's the problem with who's saying the Jain. There wasn't enough people who were senior monks and nuns, laymen, laywomen, who knew what they were talking about. But Chunda, paragraph 14, I have now arisen in the world as an Arahat, fully enlightened Buddha. The Dharma is well proclaimed. My disciples are proficient in the true Dharma. The full purity of the holy life has become clear and evident to them in the logic of its unfolding. But now I am an aged teacher of long standing who went forth a long time ago, and my life is coming to a close. So this was at the end of the Buddha's lifetime. However, there are senior teachers amongst the monks who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have attained peace from bondage. Nice term for enlightenment, peace from bondage. The idea being your five senses will, that ties you down, it puts you in a prison. And through the meditation, through the insight, you feel like you're free from prison, free from bondage. Bondage was also the term used when they had bonded slaves or bonded servants. You had to work for your master, and you just you had no freedom at all. You couldn't come and go where you wanted to. You were just a slave, a servant. Now, literally owned by somebody. Even wives used to be like that. They used to be called chattels of their husband, basically possessions of their husband. They were in bondage as well. And so you can understand what that must have felt like. And this is free from that. Be able to come and go and have choice, whatever you want to do. So that's a beautiful simile for enlightenment. So there are senior teachers amongst the monks, free from bondage, able to claim the true Dharma, able to refute by means of the Dharma, opposing doctrines that may have arisen, and having done so, give a grounded exposition on the Dhamma. There are middle-ranking monks who are the same, novices, a senior middle-ranking and novices, nuns who are disciples. That means nuns who are senior, nuns, middle-ranking nuns, novices who are disciples. There are white-robed lay followers, male and females, celibate and non-celibate, again, who are the same, and the holy life I proclaim prospers and flourishes, is widespread, widely known, proclaimed far and wide, basically well proclaimed amongst humanity in India at that time. So, you know, that's the whole reason why after the Buddha's enlightenment he taught to be able to create enough men, women, monks, nuns, to be able to carry on the teachings. And so he says, among all the teachers now existing in the world, Chunda, I see none who has attained to such a position of fame and following as I have. Of all the orders and groups in the world, I see none as famous and well followed as my Sangha of monks. If anyone were, by the monks, they also mean the nuns. If anyone were to refer to any holy way of life as being finally successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity, it is this holy life they will be describing. And now he says something from his early life. It was Uttaka Ramaputta, who was one of the Bodhisattva's first teachers, if you remember, before his enlightenment. He used to say, he sees but does not see. And no one knew what that meant. He sees but not sees. What does that mean? What is that seeing one does not see? You can see the blade of a well-sharpened razor, but not its edge. That is what he meant by saying he sees but does not see. He spoke in reference to a low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble thing of no spiritual significance, a razor. But if we're one to use the expression properly, he sees but does not see, it would be like this. What he sees is a holy way of life, which is fully successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous. I like the word nothing superfluous. There's nothing extra you do which is not necessary. Well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity. If he were to deduct anything from it, thinking in this way it will be purer, you do not see it. And if he were to add anything to it, thinking in this way it will be more complete, you cannot see it. That is the meaning he sees but does not see. Therefore, Chunda, if anyone were to refer to any holy way of life as being fully successful and perfect, it is this holy life that they will be describing. And that's again a powerful saying, because what he's actually saying, that the way it was put out, the essentials, if you add something to it, it's not going to improve it. If You take something away from it, it's not going to prove it. You can't see any way of improving it. It's a brilliant little saying there, because sometimes afterwards, sometimes people said, oh yeah, well, you know, things like the Eightfold Path, that was in the time of the Buddha, we've grown since then, we've developed, maybe we can make a Sevenfold Path. Or maybe make a Ninefold Path, make it a bit better, a bit more. And saying, no, this is the essential part teaching of the Dhamma. It's just, nothing is added, nothing is taken away. It's a powerful statement, it's very conservative, very traditionalist. But you know, the tradition is actually very simple. What many people take to be tradition these days is a lot of other stuff has been added. It's not the original teachings at all, but things which have been put on top of it. But the original teachings, things like Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, you don't really need to add too much to that. If you try, you can't really make it better. Many people have tried, I've never been able to succeed. Also, take something away, make it better, can't see it. Therefore, Chunda, all you to whom I have taught these truths that I have realized by super knowledge should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning, expression beside expression, without dissension, in order that his holy life may continue to be established for a long time for the profit and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world and benefit, profit and happiness of devas and humans. And what are the things you should recite together? They are the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four roads to power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things you should recite together. You know, the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dharmas, these are the essence of the teachings of the Dhamma. So this is almost like the summary of the main teachings of the Buddha, which the Buddha wanted people to remember. So that's why he said, come together. There were no books in those times, so they would just recite those with each other. So they keep remembering it, remembering it, remembering it, remembering it. So they always had the teachings in their head. And of course, you know, whenever we do any chanting, sometimes we make mistakes, we forget. And so when you chant it together, you can always correct your mistakes. And that is where all the chanting started from. You know, the Pirit chanting, the Sort Mon in Thailand, and the other chants which people do, which you go to Buddhist temples. That began because you had to do the chanting as the only way of preserving the teachings. You didn't have books, you didn't have internet. So they meet together and they would chant this together to make sure they keep remembering it for posterity. But now, instead of just thinking that we're doing this as a means of remembering Dhamma, we just chant for the sake of chanting and somehow think it's holy. So all that chanting which we do today, Pirit chanting and stuff, it doesn't have the meaning it used to have. The meaning before was to preserve the teachings. And thus you should train yourself, being assembled in harmony and without dissension. You've got to come together in harmony without dissension, otherwise you don't even listen to each other. If a fellow in the holy life quotes the Dhamma in the assembly, and if you think he has either misunderstood the sense or expressed it wrongly, you should neither applaud nor reject it. So if you don't agree with it, you don't reject it, you don't applaud it, but you inquire. You should say to him, friend, if you mean such and such, you should put it either like this or like that, which is more appropriate. Or if you say such and such, you mean either this or that, which is the more appropriate. If he replies, this meaning is better expressed like this than like that, or this sense of this expression is rather than that, then his words should be neither rejected nor disparaged, but you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning and expression. So it's a great little piece of advice about not to argue, but to inquire, and being very polite and respectful to each other, you know, when somebody makes a mistake. So, you know, please don't just shoot off your mouth when someone makes a mistake, even if it's your wife, your husband. You know, if your wife says something else, something you don't like, you should say, wife, if you say such and such, do you mean either this or that, which is the more appropriate? And if she replies, the meaning is better expressed like this than that, then your word should be neither rejected nor disparaged, but should explain to your wife carefully the correct meaning and expression. Can you do that in your marriage? Maybe not. But at least you'd actually inquire, what does a person really mean? before you go arguing with them. Again, Chunda, if a fellow in the holy life quotes Dhamma in the assembly, and if you think he has misunderstood the sense, though he has expressed it correctly, again you should neither applaud nor reject it, but should say to him, friend, these words can mean either this or that, which sense is the more appropriate? And if he replies they mean this, then the word should neither be rejected nor disparaged, but you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning. So in all of these ones, don't disparage. Don't call someone, you stupid idiot, you don't understand the Dhamma. What are you saying? Why do you say that? In other words, that's a very polite way, a good Buddhist way, of actually getting to a deeper, truer meaning without upsetting people and causing conflict. And similarly, if you think he's got the right meaning but expressed it wrongly. And lastly, 21, but Chunda, if you think he has got the right meaning and expressed it correctly, you should say, good. And what does that word good mean in Pali? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's what the word good means here. And should applaud and congratulate them, saying, we are lucky, we are most fortunate to find in you a friend, a companion in a holy life who is so well versed in both the meaning and the expression. You know, sometimes I keep asking you to keep praising people who deserve being praised. And sometimes instead of when they do say the right things, oh, very good. No, just go over the top with praise, because that any monk or nun who comes and teaches here, any layman, laywoman who comes and teaches here, if they teach well, say, well done, we are lucky to have someone like you who can teach us. Sing. Oh yeah, no, that was yes. You can ask Hugh about that, about how to die. Yeah, we won't talk about that now. That's a good fun on a Friday night. So, pause a little bit. Any questions so far? Because I've gone through a few pages. Okay. We're getting some more interesting stuff soon. Chunda, I do not teach you a Dhamma for restraining the corruptions that arise in the present life alone. It's not about just this life. I do not teach a Dhamma merely for their destruction in future lives, in other words, going to heaven, but one for their restraining in this life as well as for their destruction in future lives. Accordingly, Chunda, let the robe I have allowed you be simply for warding off the cold, for warding off the heat, the touch of gadfly, mosquito, wind, sun, and creeping things, just so as to protect your modesty. This is a reflection from monks and nuns about why we have robes. This is their purpose, and we always remember this. They're just for wearing off the cold. It's not for fashion. It's not for who has got the best robe. You know, it's amazing, but it's true. One of the types of cloth monks are allowed to make their robes out of is silk. And this monk over in Thailand, he offered me a full set of silk robes. I said, get out of it. I would never be able to live that down if I wore those robes in Australia. Silk robes. Who do you think I am? Some Lady Diana? Or they're very comfortable, but you know, it's not really the expression of a simple living monk wearing satin. Next, you'll have me dressed in Gucci. But you know, you're not supposed to wear sort of expensive stuff. Simple, just for you know, the sake of simplicity. So that's why we really, really try hard not to have expensive things and fancy robes. And when you get a tear in them, you put a patch in them. This is robes only 1 year, but I got my first patch a couple of weeks ago. I'm very proud of that. You know, even I'm a senior monk, I got a patch. And you know what happens sometimes? I go overseas and say, oh, you got a patch in your robe, I'll offer you a new one. No. So you know what they do? My robe disappears one night, and the following morning a new one comes. So please don't do that. We're trying to make it simple. And this is the reason why we wear these robes, for simplicity. That's the purpose, not for fashion. And you can see, even though I'm a very well-known senior monk, lots of disciples, you know, I wear the same type of robe as anybody else. You don't, because you go up in the years, you get sort of high-quality robes. It's whatever you've got. Let the alms food I have allowed for you just be enough for the support and sustenance of the body, for keeping it unimpaired for the furtherance of the holy life. So that's why we eat, just for the comfort of our bodies, so we can practice the meditation. With the thought, thus I shall eliminate the former feeling of hunger without giving rise to a new one of overeating or indigestion. So we're just trying to remember that. Don't eat too much, because otherwise, you know, the whole purpose is getting rid of those feelings of hunger, not getting new feelings of overeating. In this way I shall live without fault and comfort, and in comfort, so we can have the maximum comfort with our body. Let the lodging I have allowed for you be simply for warding off the cold, the heat, the touch of the flies, mosquitoes, winds, started creeping things, just for allaying the perils of the season and for the enjoyment of seclusion. So every monk had to be in a nun in their own little room or little hut for seclusion. That was one of its main purposes, having a hut. But not a mansion. You know, monks don't live in houses, nuns don't live in palaces. We live in huts, simple places which just satisfy those requirements. It's big enough to keep the flies, the heat, the cold out, and for the purpose of seclusion. So you can do lots of meditation. And let the provision of medicines and necessities for the treatment of sickness that I have allowed you be just again for warding off feelings of sickness that have arisen for the maintenance of health. So these are called the four requisites, the basic needs, you know, for a person. You know, clothes, food, shelter and medicines. And everything else is just extra, so we don't really need that. So that's the simplicity of a monk. And many other people look at that, that's the basic requirements for a human being. I did read years ago that I think for the Department of Social Security in UK, they thought, no, you need more than lodging and food and clothes and medicines. You also need a video player and a TV as a basic requisite of living. So even if you are poor, the government will give you one of those. Well, it's going a bit far, as if that's a necessity of life. That's right, yeah. But you know, the basic needs is what, you know, governments should, and for a good cause, good reason, should supply to all human beings. As long as they've got a place to stay, they've got food, they've got clothes. I mean, not fancy clothes, but enough to you know, ward off the heat and cold, and medicines in time of sickness. So I've always been sort of, because I'm a Buddhist, very, very positive towards free medical care. I think that's a basic requirement. And also, you know, enough housing, there's no homeless people. And, you know, plenty of food, so no one goes hungry. Basic four requisites, which here is for the monks, but that's all you want. But for all other people, at least, so society gives you that much. It may be, okay, so I'll stop there for a bit, because now we get into the really nice part. Any questions about four requisites? Okay, now we get to why I like this sutta. It may be, Chunda, that the wanderers of other sects, in other words, the other religious people of that time, might say, the ascetics, the monks and nuns who follow the Sakyan, who is the Buddha, the monks and nuns who follow the Buddha are addicted to a life of devotion to pleasure. And the reason he's saying that, because for many people this is too pleasurable. The Jains would just sleep out anywhere and they would have no clothes at all. Now they go naked, the naked ascetics. And also they would sometimes fast for days on end. And they certainly, you know, if they were sick, they would just endure it. And the Buddha would say, no, have a place to stay, simple place, but have a place to stay. Have clothes, but simple ones. Now have food every day, you know, but not too much, not too little. And when you sit, you know, seek medical care. Don't just sit there and think God will fix it. This is what the Buddha was saying. For some traditions, that was not being ascetic enough. And you were just into sensory pleasures. People said that about the monks at Serpentine when we first went there. You're living in a hut. You should be just living under a tree. You are eating, you know, nice food. You should be just living, eating moldy bread. And just rice, which has been left over from everybody else. You should just be wearing rags, not wearing these nice robes which people offer you. Maybe we had those comments when we first went. People had the idea that, you know, the more ascetic you are, the more holy you are. And still these days, especially in India, you know, if you're someone who say you eat feces, people think you're really holy. It's not feces, it's just, you know, just a brown paste they make to look like feces, which these guys pretend to eat. But it really impresses some people. They think you must be really holy to do that. So that idea that to be holy you have to be austere, the Buddha was saying no. So because of that, he said that some people might say the Buddhist monks and nuns are addicted to a life of devotion of pleasure. If so, they should be asked, what kind of life of devotion to pleasure, friend? For such a life can take many different forms. There are, Chunda, four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble, and not conducive to welfare. Not leading to disenchantment, or rather to fading away. No, so disenchantment, the dispassion here is a fading away, cessation, tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. The four kinds which don't lead to those things. Disenchantment from the world, fading away of things, cessation, tranquility, upasama, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. What are they? First, a foolish person takes pleasure and delight in killing living beings, such as going fishing or going hunting. You know, people take delight in going hunting. Like, you know, the royal family in England just going shooting birds or hunting foxes and stuff. I don't know why people get delight in doing things like that, or fishing. You know, that's not a very nice thing to be able to do, but people take delight in that. They take pleasure and delight in taking what is not given. They take pleasure and delight in telling lies, and they take pleasure and delight in indulgement and enjoyment of the pleasures of the five senses. These are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, not leading to disenchantment, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Like the five senses, watching movies, watching the cricket. Actually, I did hear the Australians won last time. So sometimes it's pleasure, sometimes it's a lot of suffering. So be careful when you watch things like sport and whatever else you do. And even listen to music. I used to like Jimi Hendrix. But I would agree with it. Doesn't listening to Jimi Hendrix does not lead to disenchantment, to fading away, to peace, to nirvana. It's a pressure which leads in the other direction. And it may be that those of the other sects might say, are the followers of the Sakyan, the Buddhist monks and nuns, given to these four types of pleasure seeking? They should be said, no. They're not following those pleasures, not killing living beings, stealing, and what's the other one? Killing, stealing, lying, or the four sense pleasure, five sense pleasure, they're not given to that at all. Because if they did say that, they would not be speaking correctly about you. They would be slandering you with four false and untrue statements. There are, Chunda, these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to disenchantment, to fading away, to cessation, to tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. The four kinds of pursuit of pleasure which lead all the way to nirvana. What are they? Firstly, a monk or nun, layman, laywoman, detached from all sense desires, that's actually letting go of all the five senses, detached from unwholesome mental states, which means the five hindrances, enters and remains in the first jhana, which is not, this is the old translation, which has the movement of the mind onto the object and sticking to the object, born of the detachment from the five senses, filled with delight and happiness, born of that detachment. And with the subsiding of the movement of the mind onto and holding the object, by gaining inner tranquility, that's actually, it's tranquility, the word is sampasadana, which is not tranquility, but more the confidence which allows you to let go that last little bit. And oneness of mind, you enter and remain in the second jhana, which is without any movement of the mind, born of stillness, filled with delight and happiness, born of stillness. And again, with a fading away of delight, remaining imperturbable, mindful and clearly aware, she experiences in herself that joy which the noble ones say, happy is she who dwells with equanimity and mindfulness. She enters and remains in the third jhana, put she in there to please you all. Again, having given up pleasure and pain with the disappearance of former gladness and sadness, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana, which is beyond pleasure and pain and purified by equanimity and mindfulness. The four jhanas. I'm not going to go into the correct explanation of those. I've done that many times before. These are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nibbana. The four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, the four jhanas. So if one or some other sect should say that the followers of the Buddha are attached. The followers of the Buddha are attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told yes, for they would be speaking correctly about you. They would not be slandering you with false or untrue statements. And I like that one, because even some monks, they say, oh, you followers of Ajahn Brahm, you're just addicted to the pleasures of jhana. Now how do you answer? You say, yes, you are right. That's what the Buddha says over here. Okay, you get it? I keep on saying this in the sutta classes. He said you're supposed to be addicted. Addicted, attached, it has the same sort of meaning. You're addicted to those four pleasures because, the Buddha said, you can be. This is the life devoted to pleasure. So are the monks and nuns at Bodhinyana Monastery addicted to the four types of pleasure? Yeah. We're addicted to the lives of pleasure. So if you want a good time, now you know where to go. Then such wanderers might ask, well then, those who are given to those four forms of pleasure seeking, how many fruits, how many benefits can they expect? And you should reply, they can expect four fruits, four benefits, that's all. What are they? The four benefits of being addicted or attached to the pleasures of the jhanas. The first is when a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, by the destruction of the three fetters, has become a stream winner, a so-on, no more subject to rebirth in the lower worlds, firmly established, destined for full enlightenment. Again, saying a stream winner, you can't get reborn in a lower state anymore. And second is when a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, by the complete destruction of the three fetters, self-view, attachment to rites and rituals and doubt, and a reduction of greed, hatred, and delusion, had become a once-returner, and having returned once more to this world will put an end to all suffering, become enlightened. The third is when a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, by the complete destruction of the five lower fetters, has been spontaneously reborn in the Sudarsana plane, and there, in that plane, will reach Nibbana without ever returning from that world. And the fourth is when a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, by the destruction of the corruptions in his very life, has by their own knowledge and realization, attained to arahatship, to the deliverance of heart and through wisdom. Such are the four fruits, the four benefits that one given to the four forms of pleasure seeking can expect. So please, you've heard that, it's the Pasadika Sutra, I've quoted it many times. People who say, don't do jhanas, you'll become addicted. Don't enjoy the pleasure of meditation, you'll become attached. Please quote this sutra and say, yes, you're right. We will become attached to those four types of pleasure seeking. And you'll be answering in conformity with the teachings of the Buddha. And you add, there are four results, four benefits of such addiction to pleasure seeking. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, full enlightenment, the four stages of enlightenment. And you'll again be teaching in accordance with the words of the Buddha. Okay? I mention that because those of you who've been around, you do hear said, jhanas, you just get attached. Jhanas, you'll never get enlightened. Jhanas, you have to do vipassana to become enlightened. Goes completely against the teaching of the Buddha. Okay, so here we go. Carrying on. Any questions about that, first of all? You're very good, not asking questions. Then such wanderers might say, the doctrines of the Sakyan followers are not well founded. They should be told, friend, the Lord who knows and sees has taught and proclaimed to his disciples principles which are not to be transgressed as long as life shall last. Just like a locking post. A locking post was this big post they used to put in the ground which showed the extent of the village. It was like a, what they call those survey posts. They tried to make them really, really strong so they could not be moved, so everyone knew where they were. Or an iron post which is deep base, well planted and unshakable, immovable are these doctrines he has taught. And any monk who is an arahat, whose corruptions are destroyed, who has lived a life, who has done what has to be done, laid down the burden, gained the true goal, who has completely destroyed the fetter of being, and is liberated by supreme insight, is incapable of doing 9 things. Now, for those of you who want to know who an arahat is, if they do any one of these 9 things, they can't be fully enlightened. So now you can find out who is enlightened. And who isn't? Okay, number 1. They are an arahat incapable of deliberately taking the life of a living being. Incapable of taking what is not given so as to constitute theft. Incapable of sexual intercourse. Just incapable. 4. Incapable of telling a deliberate lie. Incapable of storing up goods for sensual indulgence as he did formerly in the household life. Like storing up food, storing up whatever else you want to store up, storing up robes, storing up stuff. You don't store up stuff. Incapable of acting wrongly through attachment, wrongly through hatred, or wrongly through through delusion. Got folly here. Acting wrongly through greed, hatred, delusion. Incapable of acting wrongly through fear. Now, it's a fear one which many people use to see if a person's really enlightened or not. To see if they are afraid. You go out in the middle of the night, pretend you're a ghost. Ooh, ooh. Or you find them in a traffic accident to see if they're really afraid. Or, because an arahat is not supposed to have any fear. There's an old story, I mentioned it in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, of these 2 little temple boys in Sri Lanka. And they just were temple boys, as many Sri Lankans know, that they sometimes send these boys to the temple to get a good education, look after the monks, make some good karma. And both of them went up to their teacher, who was a well-known teacher at the time, and just said, well, we're here anyway, can you teach us some meditation? And so he gave them some meditation instructions. And these 2 boys, they took off in meditation. They were incredible gifted meditators. You know, getting into these deep states, nimittas and jhanas and stuff. And the teacher was so impressed, he took extra attention on these boys, especially one of them. And, you know, he was telling all the other monks, this is incredible, I've never seen such great meditators before. And he was telling all their attainments they were making. And then one day, you know, one of the boys came up to him and told him, what have been going on is meditation. And this great teacher in Sri Lanka said, this is enlightened. He's an arahat. This small boy has actually become totally enlightened. And yeah, apparently the monks who were there at the time told me the whole place was electric. Now the monastery, because everybody knew that these little temple boys were really taking off, exceeding everybody's expectations. And when their teacher said, and he doesn't tell this lightly, this guy's an arahat. And there's a tradition, and it's got some foundations to it. If a lay person, a layman or a laywoman, becomes totally enlightened, you have to ordain them within 7 days or they must die. And you know, he certainly believed that, so he didn't waste any time. He sort of ordered a car and took him to the main monastery, because in Sri Lanka you can only ordain people in the main monastery of that sect. And he sort of explained it to the head monk and said, look, this is an arahat. We better ordain him as soon as possible. So he stopped everything he was doing and organized this ceremony immediately, you know, for this young boy who's an arahat. And so he brought him back, fully ordained. I think it was a novice monk. But that was good enough to save him from death. And everybody was so impressed. They'd never seen anything like this before. No, he didn't die. Yeah. You're not reborn. That's it, you're gone. You've had enough. There's no point to living anymore. Not a bad thing, no, but he thought, but what a waste of an arahat. You know, someone's enlightened, let's keep them. They'll be able to teach and inspire people. But then, a month or two later, he had some little sickness. A local doctor saw him and said, it's only a small thing, but he needed an operation. And as soon as little boy, the arahat, heard he was going to have an operation. Now, he was from the village. He didn't know what an operation. What do you mean, an operation? Oh, they cut you open with a knife. He had never heard about anesthetic before. And so, I'm not letting them operate with me with a knife. And he was afraid. And that was when they realized he wasn't really enlightened after all. He just had some incredible meditation experiences, but it wasn't a full deal. He stayed as a monk, a novice apparently. I don't know what happened to him afterwards. He's obviously very gifted. But it was the fear of having an operation, not realizing it's going to be under anesthetic. So, you know, okay, this guy's not really an arahat or not. That's how you find out. You know, you go and sort of, you get a couple of doctors, you know, to tell Mudu sitting next to me, I'm sorry, but you have to have an operation. And unfortunately, we've run out of anesthetic. So, you know, you're a monk, you don't mind. And Sue's like, oh, I said, oh, okay, fair enough. Then he's a good monk. Okay? But that's actually how you find, because an arahat's got no fear. So that's, you know, some interesting things. And no desire, you can't have sexual intercourse, anything like that. So, you know, but please don't try that trick to try and just, you know, get some floozy from Northbridge to come and dance in front of you to see, you know, if the monk has really still got sensuality left in him. Don't do things like that. So, you know, usually the fear is the one, or the anger, so you're not an arahat. Or such wanderers might say, 27, as regard past times, the ascetic Gotama displays boundless knowledge and insight, but not about the future, as to what it will be and how it will be. That's another thing, the Buddha sort of, you know, sometimes would remember previous lives and say a lot of things about the past. But did the Buddha ever predict the future? They're actually saying here the Buddha never did predict future stuff. And they mention this. They said, that would be supposed that knowledge and insight about one thing are to be produced by knowledge and insight about something else, as fools imagine. As regard the past, the Tathagata has knowledge of past lives, and that's why he can remember these things. As for the future, this knowledge born of enlightenment rises in him. This is the last birth, there will be no more becoming. That is the only future which the Buddha knows. So a lot of times people ask that question, psychic powers, can you predict the future? Can you say what lottery number is coming up next week? If I could, we would not need to have all these fundraisers for the nuns' monastery. We could have paid that off years ago. I'd be able to travel first class wherever I go in the world. I would be driving back, you know, well, I'm not driving back this afternoon, I'm staying overnight, but when I drive back to Bodhinyana Monastery, I'll be able to drive back in a stretch limo. Do I ever do that? No, it's because we can't predict the future. If we did, I'd be rich by now. No one can predict the future, which is one of my sayings. Never trust a poor fortune teller. Obviously, if they can't tell their own fortune, how on earth are they going to tell yours? If in the past, paragraph 28, refers to what is not factual, to fables, to what is not of advantage, the Tathagata, the Buddha, makes no reply. If it refers to what is factual, not fabulous, but which is not of advantage, again, the Buddha does not make a reply. He only replies about the past if, The past refers to what is factual, not fabulous, and which is of advantage. Then the Buddha knows the right time to reply. The same applies to the future and the present. Therefore, Chunda, the Tathagata is called the one who declares the time, the fact, the advantage, the Dharma of discipline. That is why he's called Tathagata. So in other words, you know, even in the past, if it's got no advantage, you don't even discuss it anymore. So all the bad stuff which happened to you, has that got any advantage to you? No. Don't ever think you learn from the past. You learn from the present. So it's only if it's something really, really important and it's going to help you, and it's a fact, then you can talk about the past. Chunda, whatever in this world with its devas and maras and brahmas, its ascetics and brahmas, its princes and people, in other words, all the different levels of being, is seen by people, heard, sensed, cognized, whatever was ever achieved, sought after, or mentally pondered upon, that has been fully understood by the Buddha. That is why it's called the Buddha. Between the night in which the Buddha attains supreme enlightenment, Chunda, and the night in which he attains Nibbana element without remainder, whatever he proclaims, says, or explains is so and not otherwise. So the Buddha, not the Pope, is infallible. Is that the case? Can the Buddha make a mistake? Why not? The Buddha ordained Devadatta, and Devadatta tried to kill him. Was that a mistake? The Buddha ate that meat which killed him. Was that a mistake? Yeah, but then that must have been suicide. Okay, we won't go there. But it's an interesting question. Can the Buddha make a mistake? I think what most people say, make me make a mistake on worldly things. You know, on the, say, like the origin of the universe, whether it's dinosaurs or not. You know, that's just cultural, but not on the Dhamma. Did the Buddha make any mistakes? Well, this is what we argue about. When the Buddha sort of started saying about the origin of this universe, was it really accurate? Was that a mistake? Not sure, yeah. So some of the stuff, but please always never think that your teacher is infallible. Because that infallibility just means you follow everything they say. And sometimes that following a teacher or a guru leads to enormous trouble, even in simple things. When the nuns in our monastery in England, they were going on a car trip to go to some appointment, they told their driver, that was just coming up to a roundabout, go straight ahead at the roundabout. And that's precisely what the driver did. They went right over the central part of the roundabout because the nun told them to go straight ahead. And they said, I'm just following what the senior nun said. She said, go straight, and I did go straight. You may think that's silly, but that happens. So please, be careful. You know, sometimes you think they're infallible. They may be right, but you may misunderstand what they mean. So, Chunda, whatever in this world with its devas and maras, okay, I did the one, seen, heard, seen. Okay, this is the paragraph 30, I think I've got to. All such wanderers might say, does the Tathagata exist after death? Is that true, and any other view foolish? They should be told, friend, this has not been revealed by the Lord. Does the Tathagata, the Buddha, not exist after death? Does they both exist and not exist after death? Does he neither exist nor not exist? Actually, they missed out another not there. Does he neither exist nor not exist? There should be a not there, it's a typo. They should be told, friend, this has not been revealed by the Lord. Because a lot of people want to find out, if you're enlightened, what happens to you after you die? And so they say, do you exist after you die? Or does you not exist after you die? Do you neither exist nor not exist? Or do you both exist and not exist, neither exist nor not exist? So you can have a few other permutations and combinations if you like, but they're the main four ones. And they said, this is not revealed by the Lord. Then they might say, why has the Blessed One not revealed this? They should be told, friend, this is not conducive to the welfare or to the Dharma or to the high quality of life, to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, realization, enlightenment, nirvana. That is why the Lord has not revealed it. And I've told you this before, a couple of months ago, the underlying reason why the Buddha never answered those questions. Who remembers why the Buddha never answered those questions? Yeah, but why? Yeah, exactly, yeah. The whole four questions, they imply that the Buddha is a self which exists now and will somehow cease to exist afterwards. And this is not the idea of a person being a Buddha, just a process. So if they say, does the Buddha, the process of the Buddha cease rather than not exist, then the Buddha say, yeah, of course. So it's the difference between a process and a thing. A thing ceases or doesn't cease. Sorry, a thing does not exist or does exist afterwards, but a process just ceases. That's the cessation. So different words, slightly different meaning, but very important. It's not conclusive, the Buddha said, because it's not going to teach the Dhamma, it's going to imply that there's a soul or a self in there somewhere. And about 2 months ago or something, I explained the sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya from Udayan, where that is mentioned. Then this, they may say, why has the ascetic Gotama not revealed this? They should be told, oh friend, this is not conducive, that's right. Or they may say, 32, well friend, what has the ascetic Gotama revealed? They should be told, this is suffering, this is the arising of suffering, the cessation of suffering, this is the path leading to cessation of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. That has been declared by the Buddha. They may say, why has this been declared by the Buddha? They should be told, friend, this is conducive to welfare. You know, in other words, to having a happier life, to Dhamma, to the higher holy life, to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to peace, if you like, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. That is why the Lord has revealed it. Chunda, these bases of speculation about the beginnings of things which I have explained to you as they should be explained, should I now explain to you as they should not be explained, and likewise about the future, about the past? There are ascetics and Brahmins who say and believe the self and the world are eternal, this is true, and any other view is erroneous. The self and the world are not eternal, the self and the world are both eternal and not eternal, the self and the world are neither eternal nor not eternal, not eternal, the self and the world are self-created, created by another, they are both self-created and created by another, they are neither self-created nor created by another, but have arisen by chance, and similarly regard to pleasures and pain. These are some of the views you find in many religions, where they say, you know, where did the world come from? Who created the world? What created the world? And for those of you who are Buddhists, you know, they say there's been many universes, going backwards and backwards forever. No first universe, a cycle of universes. And the idea of like a soul, this is what the Buddha recognized, there is no persistent self or soul, just this process of cause and effect, like the flow of a river, never the same, under the bridge, one moment after another, looks the same but totally different water, that is your stream of consciousness. Nachanda, I go to those ascetics and Brahmins who hold any of these views, and if being asked, they confirm that they do hold such views. I do not admit their claims. Why not? Because Chunda, different beings hold different opinions on such matter. Nor do I consider such theories equal to my own, still less superior. I am their superior in regard to higher exposition. As for those bases of speculation about the beginning of things, which I have explained to you as they should be explained, why should I now explain them to you as they should not be explained? What about those speculators about the future? There are some ascetics and Brahmins who say the self after death is material and healthy, immaterial both, neither the self is conscious after death, unconscious both, neither the self perishes, is destroyed, ceases to be after death. This is true, and any other view is erroneous. That last one is the most current view of modern world, The materialist view, this idea of yourself, your consciousness, who you think you are, perishes, is destroyed, ceases to be after your death. You only have one life. That's what many people believe today, but that is erroneous. Now, Chundo, I go to those ascetics and Brahmins who hold any of these views, and if being asked, they confirm that they do not hold such views. If being asked, they confirm that they do not hold such views. I do not admit their claims. Why not? Because, Chunda, different beings hold different opinions on such matters. Nor do I consider such views equal to my own, still less superior. I'm the superior in regard to the higher exposition. As for those bases of speculation about the future which I've explained to you, they should be explained. Why should I now explain them to you as they should not be explained? And Chunda, for the destruction of all such views, brilliant, for the destruction of all such views about the past and future, for transcending them, I have laid down things like the four foundations of mindfulness, so we don't think of the past and the future and worry about them so much and try and speculate upon them. Here Chunda, a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, dwells contemplating body, ardent, clearly aware and mindful, having put aside the five hindrances. You dwell contemplating feelings, mind objects, ardent, clearly aware, mindful, having put aside the five hindrances. That is how, Chunda, for the destruction of such views about the past and future, and for transcending them, I have taught and laid down the four foundations of mindfulness. Why is the Buddha focusing on the four foundations of mindfulness here? It is because this is the present moment. The mindfulness of the body, feelings, mind objects, is all about what's happening now. Mindfulness exists in the present moment. So just learn about the present moment. Stop speculating about the past and the future. And all the truths of the past and the future can be found in this present moment. Not by looking for the future will you find its truths. Not by dwelling in the past will you discover its meaning. The truth and the meaning will be found by focusing in the present moment, now. So that's why the Buddha taught the four foundations of mindfulness. This is where you get the insights, now, not speculating about past and future. So Eckhart Tolle did not discover the power of now. He just plagiarized that from the Buddha. We Buddhists should get patents on everything. We could be so wealthy by now if we had patent on mindfulness, patent on meditation, patent on, what else do we, kindfulness, yeah. But we don't do those things. We just throw them out in the world and let people use them as they wish. During this time, the Venerable Upawana was standing behind the Lord, fanning him. That's what they used to do before when they didn't have air cons. One of the monks who would have been Venerable Mudu's job, if we did not have air conditioning, he would be fanning me. So you're very lucky these days that you don't need to waste your energy fanning me. But that's what Upawana was doing, fanning the Buddha. And the Venerable Upawana said, "It is wonderful, Lord. It is marvelous, Lord. This exposition of Dhamma is delightful, highly delightful." It's okay for monks to delight in things. Some people think, oh, monks, you should be like zombies, always walking slowly. That is not meditation, okay? That's zombie practice. You see some people doing that, walking really slowly. And you shouldn't delight in anything. You should be someone who shows absolutely no emotions whatsoever, horizontal mouth on all occasions. But you see, the Buddha and the monks did delight in things. Delight in what's worthy of delighting in. Because you're devoted to the four types of pleasures. Highly delightful. Lord, what is the name of this discourse? Well, Upawana, you can call it the delightful discourse. Thus the Lord spoke, and the Venerable Upawana rejoiced and was delighted in the delightful discourse. Okay, thank you for actually being quiet and allowing me to go through one of these suttas a long time without any questions. But now, you know, we're ahead of the time I expected, which is amazing. Any questions you have? Yeah. Is this online today? No one recorded it? Okay, because sometimes... Oh, yeah. Are you getting any questions from overseas? Wow. They're totally bamboozled.
Is the arahat detached from the pleasures of jhana?
Aha! Now that's a very good question, actually. Yes. They are detached from those. So you can be attached to them to get to the arahat, but afterwards then you are detached from them. That is the meaning of the famous simile of the raft in the Majjhima Nikaya. You use the raft to cross the stream, and that's what you use the jhanas for, to cross the stream. And once you cross the stream, you don't carry the raft with you, just in case I meet another stream. You've crossed, you're safe, done, finished. So that's where you abandon the raft, once you've crossed, as an arahat. It's not something you decide to do, it's just something which happens, you don't need it anymore. Even though they're not attached to the jhanas, it doesn't mean they don't do the jhanas. The jhanas become the default state of the enlightened being. Basically where they live when they're not doing something else. So that's why the default state of a computer. You can imagine computers in that sense, they've got some nice similes. If you don't click the mouse for a while, the computer turns off and it goes into a sleep mode. That's like if the arahat doesn't say anything, doesn't do anything, brain turns off, goes into the jhanas. The default state of the enlightened mind. Yes, my good lady.
Slightly off-field question. I'd be interested to see what you think of this one, like reincarnation versus resurrection.
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, the Catholic or Christian belief is you, when you die, you get buried, and you're going to be resurrected on some day, and there's the whole resurrection of Jesus that's celebrated. Whereas the Buddhist is reincarnation. But even within that, both of those cosmologies, a person could be like a phoenix, reincarnating and reinventing themselves all over, often.
I mean, reincarnation every moment, every day.
Well, yes.
That's it. Yeah, we're resurrecting from. You can always use those things as metaphors for part of life. You know, when you wake up in the morning, it's like you're reborn again. As long as you let go of the past, you're not a prisoner of the past. It gives you the opportunity to be free, for the future. So, and sometimes, we do go through pain and suffering in our life. And sometimes, we go through it. And it's like a resurrection, a new life comes along. If you use it as a metaphor, it can be very helpful for you. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter what their belief is; they get reborn anyway. It's whether they believe the sun is going to come up tomorrow or not. Many people believe the end of the world should come at a certain time, and many people believe in that, but it doesn't happen. The world does not go according to people's beliefs; it goes according to other laws. So, many of those laws are things like reincarnation. So it happens whether they believe in it or not. How do you mean that one? Yeah. Yes, it's out of control, whether you believe in it or not. Whether you believe you've done something right, you believe you've done something wrong, you still get praise and blame anyway. So sometimes people think through belief they can control the world. And through belief, they believe they're not going to become sick, and therefore they'll always be healthy. They believe that cancer is going to be cured by God, and they die. Now, belief has some power, but it doesn't have the sort of power people expect. That make sense? Yes. Paragraph 17, yes.
Yeah, just down the lower part of the passage. Could you start, if you don't mind, starting at the four right efforts?
Aha.
And all those follow on, the four roads to power, the five spiritual factors, etc.
Okay, in brief, the four right efforts are whatever it takes to avoid unwholesome things coming into your mind. Whatever it takes, if there are unwholesome states in your mind, to get rid of them. Whatever it takes to arouse wholesome things in your mind, like peace, like kindness. Whatever it takes to maintain those wholesome states. Now that's what I say, whatever it takes to arouse positive states of mind, to abandon and keep away negative states of mind. And you'll find that what people think as effort here is not a good translation. What people take as effort is their own egotistical striving. I am going to get rid of things. And you've heard me teach many, many times in similes like the anger-eating demon. Get out of here, you don't belong. That makes the problem worse. The monster gets bigger. People who try to get wholesome states of mind, I'm going to be kind today. My New Year's resolution is to be happy. And somebody sent me an email from the United States that 68% of people who just have a simple New Year's resolution of being a happier person, 68% of people fail in the first week. You can make New Year's resolution. You think that that's the way you can change things. You can't do it by resolution, by controlling. It's through willpower, not through effort. So through wisdom power, sorry, not through effort. So that is like the four right so-called efforts. The ability to use wisdom power to overcome the bad things in the mind and keep good things in the mind. You can try that by trial and error. You should be meditating long enough now to know that. I am not going to be angry. I am not going to be angry. And anyone who makes me angry, I'm going to smash them. This is actually basically what happens when you try to get rid of unwholesome things, they get worse. You have to use wisdom power. Find out what the cause of the unwholesome states are. Find out what the cause of the good states are, like inspiration, like kindness, like peace. Where do they come from? They don't come because you decide to create them. You understand their causes, you put those in places. That's effort. And spiritual faculties and the four roads to power. Those are the four iddies. Now, what are they? I very rarely use these these days. Chanda, Samadhi, Virya. Help me, someone. Virya, Samadhi, Chanda, Samadhi. We're monks of Samadhi. There's one more missing. Adhitana, Samadhi. This is basically the four roads to success, they sometimes call them. So, you have an aspiration. A goal, you're going to meditate. I call that the effort to actually sit on the chair. And the effort is also to investigate while you're doing these things. Find out what works, find out what doesn't work. And the energy, basically to keep on going. Don't give up so easily. And there's a fourth one. Do you remember what the fourth one is? Sorry? Panya. It could be, yeah. It could be the wisdom, understanding how it works. Some of them call it the four roads of success. Adhitana. It's not so much an adhitana. It's just having a direction and sustaining it. The ability to sustain the direction. Instead of, you decide, I'm going to meditate, but 5 minutes is too hot, I'm going to give up. So the ability to keep at the task. As you know, for everything in life, that's a road to success. Persistence. Exactly, not to willpower. You've been there and done that in your life before. You just get stressed out and stuffed up in your head. Use wisdom in all parts. Look, a good example of that. When I was a school kid in London, our school was on the banks of the River Thames. And so during the winter months, if there was the soccer fields or whatever was all snowed under or too hard, for the games afternoon, they sent us on a cross-country run. And the cross-country run was from the school over to Hammersmith Bridge on the south side of the Thames River to Barnes Bridge, over Barnes Bridge and back to school on the north bank of the river. And some kids were really wise. So, they get into their kit, they'd run over Hammersmith Bridge and they'd catch the bus to Barnes Bridge. Because they knew the teacher was on the bridge in Barnes Bridge, checking that all the kids were going down there. And they'd run a little bit, look a bit sweaty, and then they'd check in with the teacher, and when they went over Barnes Bridge, they got the bus back, to Hammersmith, to the school. Now that is using wisdom power. Instead of having to run. Okay, a few people were into running, and they took the run, but not all kids were into sport. And so a few kids, we take the bus. Now that was wisdom power. I'm not going to say whether I was one of those kids. So, spiritual faculties and five mental powers, they're actually the same. It's the the powers when the spiritual faculties really get intense. And that is confidence, the faith, saddha, wirya, energy, mindfulness, stillness, the samadhi, and wisdom. Remember a couple of years ago in Ajahn Brahm's party, I taught those five spiritual powers by the little competition. You know, I had the five questions for everybody. You know, the confidence and faith, I asked you to say something very nice about Ajahn Brahm, and the one who had the most faith, the one who's the most sycophantic, praiseworthy God, that is faith. And then for virya, for energy, I asked people to do Namo Tassa, the most energetic way they possibly could. And the team who won, they did Namo Tassa to a New Zealand, was it hiker? No, the hacker. They go, Namo Tassa, oh God, Bhagavato, Arahato, whatever it was. It was very funny. And then for mindfulness, they had to do walking meditation with very mindfulness, and the slowest one would win. And the monks, they couldn't stop. They had to keep moving. If one of the monks saw them stop, they'd be eliminated. They had to keep moving, but they had to do it very slowly for mindfulness. And for stillness, they were sitting down meditating. You remember that? I got from each group, sit down, meditate, and I got the kids who were there to try and tease them, shout in their ear, you know, pull their hair, whatever it was, to try and disturb them, to see who would last the longest when the kids were disturbing them. And the last of the wisdom, I forget, the most profound thing they could say. Whatever. But it was a little competition to make people know what those five faculties and five spiritual things were, so they hopefully they would remember them. So those are those ones. You can read them up in the book. Yes, Cheng. Cheng, come on. You've got to rush. Come on, rush, Cheng.
Just like you're saying about the four routes to power.
Yeah.
Do you think which sutta is the best to get a grasp of what is elaborate?
Where's the best place for that one? There is a very nice... Look in the Sanyutta Nikaya.
In the, it's quite messy there, you know.
No. It's in the last part of the Sanyutta Nikaya. There is one of the Sanyuttas dedicated to the four roads to power, because the last part of the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Magga Sanyutta, it's got all of these faculties with a chapter for each one, just about. So it's in, look at the last part of the Sanyutta Nikaya.
It's disorganized in that particular chapter.
Yeah. Well, look, there's five parts to it, usually. In the book we have, it's just one whole book. Sometimes it was first split into two. In a part of this, you know, five parts to it. The last part, you know, is the Magga Sanyutta. In there, it is all of the things like the four roads to power, the five spiritual faculties, the Satipatthana Sanyutta is in there as well. So if you look in that one, and look there for the four roads to power, you find them in there.
The way I see, the way I think.
Yeah.
I mean, coming to the sutta class here, there isn't really a particular sutta that is the Buddha really taught about this. No? I'm talking specifically these four roots, these four India.
I must admit, it's not talked about that much.
The way this is my own opinion. The way I think is as close as I think is I can appreciate is the Majjhima Nikaya, the one that is on the. Not chicken hand, the one that is the wilderness of heart, the Majjhima Nikaya.
Yeah, but it must say that it's not taught about that much. Eightfold Paths, Four Noble Truths, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, Seven Factors of Enlightenment are talked about far more.
But it's just that because of this, I somehow got a bit skeptical over this idea about these 37 wings of enlightenment.
Yeah, so sometimes they call it wings, parts of enlightenment, factors of enlightenment.
I'm not saying it's not relevant because if I apply on that particular sutta that I think is useful for me, but if it to read that chapter that you say in the
Sanyutta,
I think I'm a bit more lost, and it's like what everybody is trying to think. Let's get power. Let's go do this. Let's go do this.
Sometimes people think that that's the way to psychic power. But you know, that's just something which happened a long time after the time of the Buddha. The Buddha never emphasized psychic powers. He never encouraged psychic powers. When anyone did a psychic power, especially in public, he always got blasted by the Buddha for doing such things. So it just gives people the wrong message that, you know, monks or nuns who have psychic powers are freaks, you know, weirdos. So this is not what the Buddha wanted. The teaching the Dhamma, psychic power. Well, not really. The classic, now please excuse me for being gross, but this is a classic case. There was in Rajagaha this rich guy, you know, he always wanted to see someone do a psychic power. Just one person, just that's what he wanted to see. And all these other sects, they all say they had psychic powers. To find out whether it was the Jains or these other wanderers or the Buddhists, they had the goods. So he got this really expensive, valuable sandalwood bowl. And you're worth a fortune in those days. But it's useful for a monk because, you know, it's an alms bowl. You could use it for alms. And that was on purpose, to get something valuable but which, you know, the monks could actually use. And, you know, he put it on this, the top on this big bamboo pole. Now, really high up in the air, so you couldn't climb up there. And he said, this bowl is for whatever ascetic or Brahmin or monk can levitate and take it. And he announced that as a competition. And it happened, it was actually Moggallana and Palindawacha. They were walking together and Palindawacha on arms around. So he said, oh, Moggallana, you can get that bowl. Why didn't you get that bowl? It would impress people that Buddhism has, you know, got the goods. And Moggallana said, no, why don't you get it? And poor Moggallana dobbed in Palindawacha, so he rose up in the air and it levitated, took the bowl. And his big mistake was he went three times around the city. You know, that the, what do they call it, the, you know, when somebody wins the tournament, they do the three rounds of honour. Victory laps, yes. So he did three victory laps around the city, and of course everybody saw it. And then, you know, he went back to the monastery, and all these people came to the monastery to see this great monk. And it made such a loud noise, and the Buddha asked Ananda, said, what's this loud noise? Why are so many people coming to the temple today? And I said, oh, because this Palindawacha, he rose up into the air and he got this bowl and people are so excited they actually saw at last a monk levitating and everybody saw it. And the Buddha said, Palindawacha, come over here. He said, what do you do that for? And he said, please excuse me, it was gross. It's just like a prostitute shows her panties just for a few pennies. That's what you have done. That's actually a private part, not a panties. Just for a few pennies. You know, that's the sort of stuff you've done. Really sort of putting him down. So never do that again. That bowl has to be sort of smashed to bits. And, you know, he made a rule that monks are not allowed to have expensive bowls. Especially ones made of wood anymore. So, you know, that's what happened in the time of the Buddha. That's what he thought of psychic powers. You know, just showing off, you know, your private parts. This is very personal. So you shouldn't do that. Oh yeah, no, a lot of that you find in commentaries. In the suttas, it's not really talked about that much. Except there was one time that, people like psychic power stories in the time of the Buddha. There was the bhikkhunis. According to the rules, the monks have to go and teach them once a fortnight. So they would usually go to the monks' monastery. These days they do it by phone. It's too far for bhikkhunis to go all the way from Dhammasala to Bodhinyana. But so, they appointed a senior monk. You go and teach the bhikkhunis this week. This monk was so boring. Say the same thing every fortnight. And the poor bhikkhunis, they got a bit restless, you know. Can't we get someone else who can teach us something interesting instead of the same boring stuff again? And the monk heard this, oh, you're bored with this. He said, yeah, just with respect, Venerable Sir, we've heard this so many times. He said, okay, so I'll show you something else. So he rose up into the air, he flew around the room, he burst into flames, he sank into the ground, and apparently they say the bhikkhunis, never before have they been so inspired by a Dhamma discourse as this. And they wouldn't let him go back, and they didn't want to leave, so they kept encouraging him to do more and more and more until it got so late that actually when they came back, their monastery was in the town. The door was closed, the gate of the city was closed, so they had to spend the weekend, the night outside the city. And when they came into the city gate early in the morning, all the guards say, "Well, where have you been all night? You know, you scallywag nuns, you know, being out with your boyfriends." Because that's what used to happen when people come back early in the morning. And so when they got round to the Buddha, he said, "Why were you coming back so late?" And he said, "Oh, because this monk, he gave all his psychic powers to us." And so the monk got scolded. "Don't do that anymore. Teach the Dhamma. Otherwise it'd go on forever. If I started doing psychic powers over now, we would never get back to Bodhinyana Monastery until, you know, tomorrow morning sometime. Come on, give us another one." "Yeah, let's see." So that's one of the other stories in the time of the Buddha about psychic powers. So basically it was never really encouraged. Frowned upon, yeah. Even a twin miracle, that's supposed to be where the Buddha had fire and flame coming out the same, no, flame and water come up at the same time. It does not exist anywhere in the suttas. Commentaries. You look, it's not in the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, or Kudinika Nikaya. Fascinating. Why is it not in there when it's so famous afterwards? It's not in the suttas. Da, da, da. Okay, so that's enough for today. Again, thank you for listening to this long sutta, and thank you for not asking too many questions. The main part of that central part, about the life devoted to pleasure, the jhana. So don't ever think this is hard. This is, oh, you know, you guys, you don't have any fun in your monastic life. We live a life devoted to pleasure. And the result of that life devoted to pleasure is three meaning, once returning, non-returning, arahant. That's pretty cool. When I read that, I said, yes, that's what I want to do. Okay, so let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.